So, Matthew 6. Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men, to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets, to be honored by men. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by men. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. And to balance that, a passage from Revelation 20, reminding us of who actually is the person that rewards us or doesn't. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. Earth and sky fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. I think I might want to read another couple of verses. I'll read on to the end. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what he had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. If anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. I'll let you into a secret. I think I've drawn the short straw. Apparently I'm meant to talk about secrecy, and I'm not sure what I should tell you. I'm not sure there's much to tell you. I had a look in the Bible. I took up my old Cruden's Concordance with references, most of the words of the Bible, and looked up secrets and secrecy. And there's not much there. This didn't surprise me, because God is not into secrets. There's a little bit in the Old Testament about entering the Holy of Holies. And you might get the idea that if you work hard, and if you know the secret ceremonies or the passwords or whatever, you might get special access to God. But God is not really like that. God is in fact very open. God hasn't signed the Official Secrets Act. He's more likely to have signed the Freedom of Information Act. God reveals. God gives. Right at the beginning we see that God wanted light. The gospel is good news. It's news, something to be told, not something to be kept secret. At the beginning of John's gospel we read that Jesus himself is described as light. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. He himself was not that light. He came only as a witness to the light, the true light, that gives light to everyone who comes into the world. And of course, as a consequence, later in chapter 3, we read that this is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light, because their deeds were evil. Everyone who doesn't evil hates the light, will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. Whoever lives by the truth comes into the light, so that we may be plainly seen that what they have done has been done in the sight of God. Later in chapter 8, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. God isn't into secrecy. You might like to think that Christianity is a bit of a mystery, but even when Paul writes about this mystery, it's in the context of a mystery being revealed in Romans, in 1 Corinthians, Ephesians. I'll read a little bit from Romans, which end of Romans says, "To him who is able to establish you in accordance with my gospel, my good news, the message I proclaim," not secret, "the message I proclaim about Jesus Christ, in keeping with the revelation of this mystery, has now been revealed and made known by the command of the eternal God, so that all Gentiles might come to obedience." God is an open God. God is a God that proclaims. And the last book of the Bible, as you know, is called, and gives the game away, Revelation. You know, sometimes we feel that God hides from us. But except for when it is our sin that puts up the barrier between us and God, that is for our God, our good. The prophets didn't dare look at God directly. Paul speaks of seeing him through a glass darkly. This is a bit like wearing sunglasses, because we can't take the full glare of his light. I say God is into openness, freedom of information. There's no limit to the information that he can impart. The limit is to the amount that we can take. It's as though I asked for all the WikiLeaks data to be downloaded onto my mobile. It hasn't got the bandwidth. And if it did come in one fell swoop, the poor phone would curl up and die. The computer can't take it. We cannot take the fullness of God. So God protects us from his holiness. As we come to the communion in a little while, we will take and eat. "This is my body given for you." And Jesus gives his all. But we only take a little. We take what we can hold. We take what we can absorb. The Spirit comes to fill us, but it's only a fraction of the Spirit. There is always more. There's no secrecy from God. There is no withholding because we're not worthy, not properly initiated. There's just careful protection and nurture. He's feeding us on milk until we're able to grow to take more of God. So remember that God is open. God gives. So where does this idea of the spiritual discipline of secrecy come from? I had a look in a couple of older books that Jeff gave me, Celebration of Discipline by Richard Foster. Not there. Perhaps it's a new thing. Perhaps we need secrecy now and didn't in the past. The Life You've Always Wanted by John Ortberg has this chapter on the discipline of secrecy. And John links secrecy with freedom, which seems strange as I think of them as opposites. But John's freedom is freedom from what he calls approval addiction. And the secrecy is his way of dealing with this temptation, this sin, to want approval addiction. So I want us to spend some time facing up to this problem, acknowledging that we live in a world which pushes us to want to stand out, to be significant in some way, to improve our image or our self-image, to judge ourselves by how others judge us. And it's clear from his book that it gets to Christians as well. It got to him. He began to think of himself as actually significant, that he was special. People used to go around with an armband, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Now I think they go around with an armband, WWOT, what would others think? The trouble is, we are in danger of judging ourselves by others, defining our identity by what we perceive others consider to be important. In my youth, I would have spoken of my alter ego, that version of myself based on my background and family and upbringing, which is always looking over my shoulder and saying, "Neil, that's just not good enough. You know you can do better than that, you should aim higher. John Ortberg uses a more sociological account and speaks of our generalized other, that combination of all those things in our past and in our group whose approval we desperately seek. But whatever language we use, it is real in our lives. It's real in our culture. We must acknowledge it. And nowadays, it's there right from the start. Typically, we belong to a small family, maybe no siblings, so the expectation on us as individuals is all the higher. Or too often, we come from broken families where the parents are split and our single parents turn their expectations even more fiercely on us. And in the wider world, before we're into our teens, certainly before we're out of it, we're bombarded with questions. What are you going to do when you leave school? What's your career? What's your aim in life? 100 years ago, with a silly question, the answer would have been going down the mine, to the quarry, to the mill, into service, just like our parents. There was no choice. Life was set out for us, not saying it's better, but there's that expectation on us to be different, to be special. Then we knew we would not stand out of the crowd. We would have solidarity with the people around us. Now we are pressurized to be different. We get our identity from the comments and the support of the people around us. By our mid-teens and onwards, we have to write our CVs with our personal statements. They're meant to be a reflection of ourselves and to be a true statement of what we're like. But I've never read one which said, I thought about doing the duty of Edinburgh's award but couldn't be bothered. Or, I've applied for 95 jobs, I'm not at all interested in your company but I need the money. No, we continually in the business of trying to impress. And when we fail, we go for advice and have a makeover of our CV, of our looks, of our clothes, not of ourselves. John Ortberg stresses this desire we have to please our generalized other, to develop our friends and form our actions so that we get a positive feedback. And that's what he thinks is what Jesus was getting at in chapter 6, where these people were out to impress as they paraded, as they blew the trumpet and walked along the high street and said, how good I am. And we're all like that. It's not just the Pharisees. It's not just special religious leaders. It's not just the people in the high positions of society. Even in small one-eyed towns in Galilee, people are like that, trying to make an impression. And it's exactly the same here in Bangor, trying to make an impression. 40+ years ago, I came here from Oxford. Shows how much I've got settled here. And you know that Oxford and Cambridge are places of prestige and places of privilege, and you can think, well, they're them, but we are ordinary people. When I came here, I was amazed how much the university thought about one particular person because he was an FRS, Fellow of the Royal Society. My boss back in Oxford was an FRS. He went on to be not just any old FRS, but the president of the Royal Society. He didn't get a Nobel Prize because there isn't a Nobel Prize in mathematics. Mathematicians have to do something else. So every 4 years, all the mathematicians get together and he got the corresponding award to a Nobel Prize. There were several other people in the department. Several of them had FRSs. They were not quite to a penny, but of the 1,400, a number were there. A number. That's people with quality, which are special. Come to one place here. I looked on the web trying to find out how many FRSs Bangor had. Couldn't see any. Maybe wrong, but there were a few that are honorary, but Bangor would like to pick the names in and try and get the status from them. We want to impress, and even me in a small group, we impress just as much as if we're in a big group to say how good we are. how special we are. A little while ago, a few minutes ago, I mentioned this special 200th anniversary in Penrhyl. Great from Bangor's point, from Penrhyl's point of view, because we're a good public church. We've done great things. Next week, Peter is going to go down and give them a cheque for £10,000 from our church. And they're going to think either we're a lot of rich people who can afford to throw money away like confetti, or they're going to think that's a good church who's really kind and generous to them. All our members thought that was a good idea to give £10,000. We have 100 members. £10,000 divided by 100 is £100 each. But it's amazing that 90% of us are convinced we're in the poorest part of that 10,000. In our instincts, we think, that's a lovely idea, we'd like to be attached to it, but we don't connect it with ourselves inwardly. In what we do, we want to get the esteem, we want to get the feeling of satisfaction by being associated with something that's good. Of course, sometimes we go to the other extreme. We're not good, we're bad. All the things which you read about Christians coming to God, the good tales, the interesting ones, are the ones that were really in the gutter and were pulled out, not the ones that were ordinary and how God changed them. And if we're ill, we need a label for our illness to show that we're especially ill. If we're poor, we need a label for how poor we are. We justify ourselves and make our mark by how poor we are. We're good at that in Wales. We're good at that in Bangor. We're good at saying that Bangor is a small place. Bangor has one of the largest council estates in Wales. Bangor is an economically deprived area. It's one of the poorest regions in the EU. We can't possibly do anything. We're blighted before we start. We demand your sympathy. Because we're not good enough. We may be, and we get the feel in to go in the opposite direction of being weak and poor and unable. And that makes our status in society. I happen to see a headline, I think it was in the Daily Post, bemoaning how bad we were in some area here in Wales. Was it health, employment, housing, I forget. As I say, Wales has been good at this complaining mode. The headline went something like this. Wales is the third worst in the UK for... dot, dot, dot. I forget what it was that Wales was the third worst in the UK for... But given that there are only four countries in the UK, I couldn't quite work out why this was such a bad statement. Paul got fed up with this petty-minded desire to look good. He eventually lost it in Philippians chapter 3. He said, if someone else thinks they have reason to put confidence in the flesh, others think themselves good, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard of the law of Pharisee, as for zeal, persecuting the church, as for righteousness based on the law, faultless. He listed his credentials. He said, if you think you are okay, you should see something that is really good. But whatever were gains for me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is the more, I consider everything lost because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. Paul said, I'm good, I'm special, but that's just superficial. I know that really I'm not. My worth comes from knowing Christ, and from that alone. In Galatians 1, he said it more bluntly. Am I now trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? Am I trying to please people? If I'm trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Christ. And I think we have to get this feeling that we are ordinary. We're not special. A few weeks ago, Roger was speaking and he brought a prop. So I thought I would bring a prop. And I need a charming assistant, so Brian, would you come? And hold the... Because, as you may have heard, the group was making... This will sound good on the tape, but still. Was making some cakes. And selling them. And they did it about a fortnight ago, and they're doing it today. Different groups from the youth for Penrose. So, what do you do with cakes? Cakes are nice things because they're sweet. So I think we have some sugar for this. Now, we put some sugar in. I never know quite how much sugar to put in, but... I tend to think there's never such a thing as too much sugar. So, in principle, why not let's have the lot, shall we? Yeah. I'm inclined to put a bit more, because I'm not sure whether it's quite sweet enough. So, perhaps we'll add a bit more, just in case. Yes. This is from a different bag, so we're going to have difficulty in a while get separating the two bags, but making sure which one's one and which one's the other, but you can have a bit more. Well, why not? There we are. My main contribution to cakes is the eating part of it. I'm not very good at the rest of it. Now, right, so this is a way of getting this prop out. So, now, a spoon. I would say we ought to check that it is sugar. A while ago, when the youth were doing it last time, they got some white powder out of the cupboard. Now, it wasn't the white cupboard of choice for most teenagers in Bangor. We don't tend to stop that here in case we get raided. But it wasn't sugar, apparently. So it went in the cakes and they decided to change it. So it's sensible to test that it is sugar. And I would have normally said, just lick your finger, stick it in. But health and safety won't allow us to do things like that. So we'll have to do it with a spoon. So now I just want you to take one grain. No. I want you to take the nicest grain. I want you to take a special grain. I want you to find one which is really going to, you're going to really treasure, you're going to look after, you're going to like, you're going to want. Ignore all the rest. Just pick the one grain, you know? Right?
I can't.
Sit down, yeah. I think I have made a point there about by doing such a stupid conversation. But that's what we tend to think of ourselves. We think we are the unique one. We forget that we're not one in a million, it might be you. We're one of 7 billion. And we have no concept of what 7 billion is, so we shrink ourselves down to this lot, and we are one of these things, and we can stand out. But we are one of 7 billion. We tend to think that God called us for a special work and we are the unique, because all the comments are based on the individual. But I don't think that is right. We tend to think that Moses was special, that he was chosen by God. And he was chosen by God. But is our picture of this burning bush and God standing there biting his fingernails saying, I hope... stoke it up a bit lighter. I hope Moses will see it. Whatever will happen if Moses misses it, the children of Israel won't be rescued if he misses it. Was God's rescue of the children of Israel dependent on Moses? No, it was dependent on God. He chose Moses. Moses responded. We don't know whether other people walked past and ignored it. Maybe God spoke to other people beforehand. We are not special. We are unique. God loves each of us, but we are not special in the sense that we are not more important than the other. James and John went through this process. They wanted to be the two important points in the kingdom. And that's common to all of us, to have that desire to be approved by people, to be approved by God, to be set apart. But we are one of the family of God. I have two grandchildren. At the moment, I have two grandchildren who are only children at the moment. They are loved by their parents, but in a fortnight for one and about a month for the other, they will suddenly find they have siblings. They will not be loved any less, but they will no longer be the only person. And we are not the only person that God loves. He loves all, not just me. So, if our search for approval is to get this view from getting other people to think good of us, how do we counter that? And I have three suggestions coming partly from this. The first is basically shut up. This guy's an American, so he writes this in a more tactful form, but that's the sort of English translation of it. And he says that he thinks that's what Matthew 6 is saying. Stop making a song and dance about what you're doing. Stop playing to the crowd. Stop telling everyone what good you are doing and how you need it and expecting them to congratulate you. And if it's bad, stop going on about how bad it is and hunting for the sympathy vote. Don't cover your face in ashes when you fast. Yes, you may be hungry, but don't go out of the way to make everybody miserable because you're hungry. Don't dress up in spiritual language saying how you've been blessed or how you've been tried or how you've been tested or whichever way it is. Basically, shut up. Do things in secret. Don't think about it yourself. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand's knowing. Well, of course your left hand does know what your right hand is doing, but don't go thinking about it and talking about it and baking it on your own self. Don't turn your mind in on that. So John's suggestion is to do things secretly. That's where the secret comes in. To cut down on our own agenda and be available for others. Even to go out of our way to do voluntary work for other people without telling anybody about it. I'm not sure that's going to work with you. I don't think it's going to work in North Wales. You can't do anything in secret without somebody saying, I saw you there because all my cousin's aunt saw you and what were you doing? So it won't work. But it's certainly the right approach. Round here, your right hand is nosy about what your left hand is doing and will tell you anyway. But the suggestion is basically, shut up. Stop having the focus on yourself. I don't think that's going to work, but it's worth a try. My second suggestion is, shut up. One of the reasons the News of the World made so much money was that we all went out and bought it. One of the reasons the Pharisees paraded down the high street was people stood and watched them. We're going to have the Olympic flame, apparently, going from Aberystwyth to Bangor, 90 miles in one day. But the mayor and whoever the various people are, the dignitaries and the people called in to do it, they're not going to run the 90 miles. They're going to go to the outside of town, jump in a car and drive to the next bit. Get out. Whenever there's a crowd, they're going to come and wave. When there isn't a crowd, they're doing going on. They're going simply so that people can be seen. One of our problems is that we act as the crowd and encourage other people. So I ask you, you're very good at giving people advice, you're very good at being coaches, you're very good at being the crowd at a football match. Be the right sort of crowd. Can I suggest you help to train others to do things in secret? Not so much by telling them to do it in secret, by not showing so much interest in what they are doing. Can we ourselves shut up with our adulation of others and concentrate our conversation not on what we have done for God or even on asking what you have done for God, but on what God has done? And that's my third and final suggestion, which takes us back to Revelation. Remember whose opinion is important.